Hello, I'm John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of Motor One, and welcome to this week's episode of the MotorOne.com podcast. This week, Volkswagen introduced the eighth generation of its Golf hatchback, a global car that's one of the best-selling automobiles of all time. It offers a comically long list of power options, and it looks, well, it looks like Golfs have looked for decades, just a little newer. On today's episode, we're going to talk about this mega important debut, as well as hatchbacks in general. They're a curious type of car that Europeans love, and we Americans seem to change our minds about a lot. Joining me is MotorOne.com writer Chris Bruce. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
And in the other chair is senior editor Greg Fink. How are you doing, Greg?
Great, John. How are you?
Very good. Thanks. So the Golf debuted just a few hours before we started recording, and it's been very popular on the site. Everyone's interested in it. And it's a very global car. Like I said, it's one of the best selling of all time. Actually, it's number three on the list behind the Ford F-Series pickup, which is number two. And you guys know what is number one?
It's the Corolla, if you go by nameplate, right?
It is. It is the Corolla. So it's the Golf is third on the list. So Chris, you wrote the debut post on Motor One all about this car, and I sympathize with you because it was a very long press release that you had to synthesize and summarize for everybody. So I'm going to turn the mic over to you. Can you tell us kind of the main highlights of the new Golf?
Sure thing. So the new Golf, it's in terms of size, it's practically identical to the old Golf. If you look at it, it's just a hair longer. It's less than an inch longer. It's actually skinnier than the old one. And the wheelbase changed by, get this, a single millimeter. So it's pretty much as close
counting
to the old one you could have as you can imagine. In terms of styling, they really sharpened it up, especially at the front. The front is where you'll notice most of the changes. The rear also has sharper taillights and things like that. But where you really notice the difference is inside. Digital instrument cluster like you would find on Audis is now standard across the board on the Golf, which is really impressive. You get an 8.25-inch infotainment system standard, and you can upgrade to a 10-inch system, and those look really nice together from the photos that we're getting. And then it just has a lot of tech. Like, it, Volkswagen really kind of packed this thing with cutting edge features. People with certain Samsung phones are going to be able to use that as the vehicle's key, and you're even going to be able to let other people into your car with your Samsung phone key. So that's both scary in a certain way and then also very interesting.
In this age of hackers.
As an optional feature, they're having what they call Travel Assist, which is their driver assistance system, but it will do all braking, gas, steering in a single lane for you. And at speeds up to 131 miles per hour, which is great for the Autobahn, not so much for Americans, but still. And it also gets Car2X communication, which is something we've been hearing about for a really long time. And that means that it can communicate wirelessly both with other cars and with the infrastructure once that's supported. In this case, it is up to 2,625 feet, 800 meters radius. So any cars with this feature, and it is a unified system in Europe, so it won't just be Volkswagen's eventually, and they will be able to communicate with each other. And so your car will know if there is a broken down car up the road or a wreck or, you know, people are slowing down. So that could be really important for safety in the future.
Yeah, that's a really cool technology, but I mean, it takes like not just widespread adoption, it kind of takes 100% adoption to get the full advantage of. But
right,
once that's set up, you know, being able for cars being able to communicate with each other, and I like the idea of cars knowing exactly the position of other cars around them. That's cool. And also the car to infrastructure is really cool. Like, you know, you could be pulling up to a McDonald's and you've already got your order, you know, on file in your car. And as you pull up, it just, you know, beeps it into them when you pull into the parking lot. Of course,
yeah, it's early days for all this stuff, but yeah, sorry for interrupting you. It's early days for all this stuff, but it's interesting that they're adopting it now. If someone who buys one on the first day that they're available, they're probably not going to be able to take advantage of that tech as much as, you know, maybe 5-10 years down the line when it'll really be useful.
Yeah, but you got to start somewhere, and cars are on the road for 5 to 10 years now, so it makes sense. I have to say, let me give my opinion on both of what you just talked about, the exterior and the interior. The exterior, to me, I'm disappointed with, but I feel like I'm kind of always disappointed with new Golfs because they always look like old Golfs, as I mentioned in the introduction. They're always evolutionary. They're never revolutionary. And obviously that's by design, and this is an incredibly important, iconic car for Volkswagen, and maybe they're just not interested in taking a risk with it. But for me, I think that is true of a lot of Volkswagen and of its sister brand, Audi, where they have kind of fallen into a rut of evolving their designs to the point where when a new design is out, it doesn't really feel new. It just feels a little different. That said, man, the inside, the interior, the dashboard is extremely futuristic and you're right, packed with tech. Obviously the screens jump out at you because there's one for the gauge cluster behind the steering wheel and a giant one above the center console. And to me, they kind of remind me of the current setup that Mercedes has, where it has kind of two giant screens on the same plane, the same horizontal plane across the dash. This is a little bit similar. These two giant screens are kind of right next to each other and almost look like they're together, but they're not.
Yeah, but it's worth pointing out that, you know, the Golf is a whole price class lower than an A-Class or a CLA, and you're still getting that tech. So I think that's important to point out.
Yeah, the trickle down of it's really the trickle down of like screen size that has has come down into the least expensive cars on the market, which is great. I mean, I remember 5 years ago where there was still a question of whether you'd get a screen or not. There, mm-hmm. you'd either get a screen or you'd get like a little LCD display in a giant swath of plastic where a screen would be. But now they just give everybody the screen, and it's just a matter of whether you get like navigation with it or not.
And you brought this up, but this thing, at least in Europe, is available with just a hilarious number of powertrain options. Volkswagen's actual press release says it's 8, but in the office, we counted through them and actually came up with 11. 3 cylinders and 4 cylinders. There's 5 hybrids. There's 2 different diesel options. It's just, it's crazy that they're offering this one vehicle at launch with so many powertrains. And we know that there are more on the way because the GTI and the Golf R and stuff like that are coming.
And probably, I don't know, do they say whether they'll do pure electric versions?
Isn't that what ID is for?
Yeah, is that what they're replacing the e-Golf with, is just ID, that line of vehicles? I think that might be the case.
I would imagine. I don't know, though. The ID impresses me more than this new Golf, I gotta say. I'm a little disappointed with the Golf when this ID is here, and I think the ID3 seems to make more of a splash, and the Golf kind of does a lot, but is still a Golf, for better or worse.
I agree. Look at that. Look at the ID3's design, and it looks like what I imagine a good redesign for the Golf should be. Like it's a futuristic, forward-looking version of like a Volkswagen hatchback, whereas this Golf 8 to me is just, it's just a different Golf. It doesn't feel like a new Golf so much as just another take on the Golf.
Well, to be fair, Volkswagen is notorious for doing this. The last one, like Mark 5 and 6, were on the same platform, and Mark 6 was really just a super facelifted, you know, lots more than your normal just a new front fascia type of thing going on, mm-hmm. but it's still the same chassis underneath, and this is MQB underneath. It's just a very heavy, they call it a redesign, but you can make the argument it's a very, very, very heavy facelift.
But you're right, Chris. I want to go back to the fact that there's 11 different power options for the current one, and that's not including the GTI that we know is coming. And then what are the other versions besides the GTI?
Golf R... and
the diesel GTI version, the GTD,
the GTE, which is the they have showed the a plug-in one of it.
Wow. Yeah, that's the GTE.
Yeah, that one's the only one that interests me. Did you see the little like fog lamps area that are the fog lamps that are kind of built into the honeycomb pattern on the lower grill?
No, I didn't look at it on that one.
It's cool. The GTE's kind of got me. It's got like 240 horsepower. It's a plug-in, and I bet add some red accents and you pretty much have a GTI from how it looks.
Right. Well, let's the fact that there are these the high performance options that are on their way kind of leads us into the next thing we should talk about concerning the Golf, which is the fact that the regular Golf may not even come to the U.S. This debut happened in Europe, and obviously they're going to sell all of these versions of the Golf in Europe. But as we reported earlier in the year, Volkswagen has not decided whether it will sell the regular Golf in the U.S., although they have told us the higher performance versions, they will continue to sell in the U.S. And that's funny because I've pointed out to you guys at the beginning of the month when the sales numbers come out, I've brought up the fact that in the U.S., the high performance Golfs, the GTI and the R, actually outsell the regular version of the Golf, which is kind of hilarious and a little sad for a car that, you know, has sold so many, sold enough to be the third best-selling car of all time, and it really doesn't sell that well in the U.S. So I want to put that question to you. If you were a Volkswagen executive and had to make the decision, considering what's in your lineup now and what the trends are and the tastes are in the U.S., would you decide to sell this Golf 8 in the U.S.? Chris, what would your answer be?
That's a hard question because you also have to remember that the Beetle is getting the axe too. So if they only offer the GTI then is going to become the entry-level Volkswagen, or Volkswagen car at least, and that's kind of a weird thought.
Well, and they're not even selling the ID3 here. So like they're not going to have a small hatchback, really. You're right, unless you go up to the high-performance Golfs.
It's just weird to think of as a GTI as the entry-level Volkswagen car.
Well, the Jetta would be the entry-level car still.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? You're absolutely right.
It'd be the entry-level hatchback, at least.
Yeah. Yes, that's the one it would be.
But, and honestly, they have, what's it called? I don't know why I'm blanking out on the name, but the new smaller SUV, Tarok, or something like that.
Well, there's the T-Roc in Europe.
T-Roc, but there's the other one that's going to be built in Mexico, I want to say, that's coming up here. I want to say it's called Tarok. I'll double check that before the end of this. It's probably going to start at a price that more levels the playing field to keep people able to get into a Volkswagen hatchback at around the price of the current Golf.
Yeah, I'm going to say if I were a Volkswagen executive, I wouldn't bring it over. They already have. We've reported on the fact that they have at least two more crossovers coming to the United States.
Right.
And I think one of them is the even smaller one you're talking about, Greg. I would like to see them bring the ID3 over. They're going to bring an all electric small crossover based on the ID3. But I would actually like the ID3 over as a small hatchback. But, you know, it's just the again, when you look at the tastes and trends in the U.S. and just how SUV obsessed we are, I think they could probably sell more if they sell more units of vehicles if they just sold a Golf-sized SUV rather than the Golf itself. You know, like I said at the beginning, Europeans have always been in love with hatchbacks, and it makes sense for, I think, the geography, you know, with shorter trips, smaller roads, things like that. And in the U.S., we love them sometimes, like when they're interesting, like when they are the GTI or the Golf R, but just regular hatchbacks kind of come and go in this market, and no one really bats an eye at them.
Well, and then the other thing, too, is I want to be sad that this Golf, I don't think will end up coming here. If I were Volkswagen, I agree, I would not bring it here. I want to be sad about that, but then I think about it. If I were in the buying position, which the Golf is a vehicle I love and I would buy, I would never get the regular Golf. I would get the GTI at least, and they're bringing that here. So they're satisfying my needs. They're satisfying their business needs. It makes the most sense to just keep it at the, you know, make performance people happy with GTI and R, and the hatchback people will move to. It is the Tarek, T-A-R-E-K is what it's supposed to be called. The Tarek or a Tarek. Tiguan or something that, you know, or a Jetta if they are willing to give up the hatch. They have options, though.
Yeah, going back to the sales numbers, if they don't bring the regular Golf to the U.S., we're only talking like 1,000 units a month. It sells very low volume here in the U.S. So even I don't think anybody would miss it. I think it would be a footnote in history that it's not sold here anymore. But as a business decision, I don't know. I think I think they'd be smarter to execute the plans they have, keep it crossover heavy. Although, like I said, I would like to see the ID3 here. The crossover version of the ID3, by the way, is the unimpressively named ID4. So that's what we're going to get, which is basically just kind of a jacked up ID3. So we were talking a little bit before the podcast too about the Golf in general, and there have been so many versions sold both in the US and around the world that we know we have our favorites. So in honor of the eighth generation of the Golf debuting, let's go around the horn and talk about our favorite Golfs of all time. So again, Chris, I'm going to start with you. Why don't you give us one or two of your favorite Golf models of all time?
Sure thing. So first, I have to mention the Mark II GTI. It arrived in the U.S. in 85. I have fond memories of these because my science teacher in high school drove one, and I always thought that was cool. And I've just... the first gen, the Rabbit GTI in the U.S. kind of created the hot hatch genre. The Mark II is what really cemented it. Just great boxy German styling, really fun to drive, great looking. I love them. In addition to that, moving several decades forward, there's the kind of the often forgotten Golf R32, which was it was introduced in Europe in 2003. It came to the U.S. in 2004. And it was essentially the kind of the ultimate performance version at the time. It used a 3.2 liter version of the famous VR6 that has predated it and then kept going well afterwards. It had all-wheel drive. It was just kind of a killer at the time. Plus, they looked good. They had a really kind of aggressive yet handsome body kit on them.
Yeah, so. I think the R32 is one of the most handsome golfs ever made, if not the most.
What it really does well is that it does look kind of, you know, mean and aggressive. It's got kind of really big side sills and larger intakes than you usually see, but it doesn't go overboard. It still has that kind of classic Germanic thing of being handsome and aggressive at the same time.
Yeah, very good choices. Very good choices. Greg, how about you?
Well, I agree with that R32, and that actually might be my favorite. But I have some skin in the game, having been a former Jetta GLX VR6 Mark III owner. It's not a Golf, but I love that car, and I'd be happy to have the Golf version of it. It was, that VR6 was just so fun, and the car's kind of light. It's kind of probably not the most fun of the GTIs to like the real GTI fans, but I loved it, and I got to give that car the nod for me.
Yeah, very good choice.
Mark III was 94 through 98, I want to say.
Okay. My choices are two oddballs. You guys, I think, stayed on the straight and narrow. I'm gonna choose some offbeat ones. The first one is the Harlequin Golf. And if you guys probably know what I'm talking about because they pop up every once in a while on like for sale or bring a trailer. But these are the Golfs where Volkswagen basically took a body panel from every color Golf and put them all in one car. So and they could be, it could be anything. So for instance, like the hood could be red, the front fender's yellow, the front bumper blue, the front door's red, the D-pillar green. And it was really just a simple idea because, you know, it's not hard to, you know, paint these parts separately and then assemble them.
Well, they were all the existing colors, too. So they just exactly. Like, take a green fender off of that side of the assembly line, take a blue door, and yeah.
Exactly. And it's so strange to look at because it doesn't look like what you might expect. When I describe it in words, I think in my head like a junkyard special where like, you know, somebody, you know, got hit in the door and they replaced it with, you know, a door from a junkyard. It's not like that because these are all like pristine, well-painted panels. They're just all different colors. And what I think is interesting about it is when it's all one color, kind of the door lines and the hood lines, those all kind of blend away a little bit. But when they're all different colors, all those lines are suddenly in extreme relief, right? They're you're seeing exactly where the door line is because there's two contrasting colors there. I don't know if I could drive one every day and answer the questions that I'm sure you get when you're driving this car. But I just think it was one of the coolest most fun things I've ever seen come out of an automaker. The second one is another rare one. It wasn't produced very long. It was early 90s, and it was called the Golf Country, or the Golf Country Synchro. And it was basically a five-door Golf, again, like 1990s, jacked up and with four-wheel drive. So it was almost like the small crossover progenitor of the Tiguan or something like that. Long before SUVs and crossovers became popular. And, you know, it was underpowered. It had like 100 some horsepower engine and a 5-speed. And they were not sold in the US. However, you can find them for sale every once in a while. And every time they pop up, it catches my eye.
But they look really cool. They have a brush bar on the front. Like, they look way more aggressive than they should.
Yeah, than you would think.
It looks like someone modified them, but they didn't.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way to put it. It looks like a one-off custom thing that a shop did, but no, it came from the factory. And I've always seen them in this kind of light blue, I don't know, is it teal or like blue-green color? I've never seen them in like any other color, except maybe they were produced in others, but this is the most popular one they're usually seen in. And yeah, it's one of those cars where every time I see one for sale, I'm like, man, I wouldn't mind having that in my garage. That would be really fun. But I've owned a lot of mid-80s and early 90s VWs. I don't know if I want to do that again. That's a young man's game.
I should say real quick before we move on, I think I said Mark IV when I meant Mark III before, because I'm brain farting. It's been a long week. I'm moving as well, so I take that one, and I looked the years up. Mark III was 93 through 98 in the U.S.
Okay, so then your choice is Mark III, 93 to 98, either Golf GTI or Jetta GL6.
Yeah,
with
GLX
the VR6, though, right?
With the VR6. Okay, gotcha.
But I might have said Mark IV earlier. It's been one of those weeks.
That's all right. You corrected it now, so we don't have to do a retraction.
Mm-hmm.
The VR6 just seems like such a big engine for those cars, doesn't it? Like, you see this little car, and then it's got a pretty decent-sized engine in it. They're interesting.
It was a very American way to go about it, I feel like. It's like the muscle car equivalent of a hot hatch.
Yeah. Wasn't the VR6 like a very compact six-cylinder because its angle of degree was a little smaller
than most
V6s?
It was super tight.
It was compact.
Yeah. It's got one head on the top as opposed to, you know, having two sets.
Yeah,
it was a V in the cylinder, but yeah, it only had one head. So it was compact for compared to a normal inline six, but it was, you know, V6. I don't think. Probably a little less
wide. What about hatchbacks in general? Are you guys fans, or could you take them or leave them?
Of the three cars that I've owned, at least arguably two of them have been hatchbacks. My first car was the original, the first gen Saab 900. So whether you want to call that a liftback or a hatchback. So I am definitely a hatch fan.
I don't think you're allowed to be in this business and not be a fan of hatches.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not anti-hatch, but I went back, you know, looking through the cars I've owned, and I have had hatchbacks. I had an 84 Celica and an early 80s Dodge Charger, but I also didn't think of them as hatchbacks so much as coupes, you know, and sometimes, you know, hatchbacks can be really like a coupe shape, and the fact that they're a hatchback is just a function of where the hinge is for, you know, the rear door, whether it's a trunk or a hatch. When I think of hatchbacks, though, I think of, you know, Golfs and Minis and things like that. And I've actually never owned one of those, you know, not because I haven't wanted to. Although I take that back. We just recently got rid of it, but we had a 2014 Kia Soul. And some people consider that a hatchback, which it, of course, is.
Oh, yeah, I totally think it is.
I also viewed it as a subcompact crossover, which many people do not because it does not have four-wheel drive. So it's definitely a hatchback, though. And we did love it, but I didn't like walk up to it seeing a hatchback. When I think hatchback, I think more low to the ground, you know, Golf and like I said, Mini and things like that. And
see, I lumped the Soul in with the Scion XB and Nissan Cube.
Yeah, the box cars.
Yeah. So I consider both of those hatches. I wouldn't call either one of those a crossover. But.
No, I wouldn't either. But that was also definitely like a weird offshoot of like boxcars that existed and only the Soul survived.
Yeah.
And did so well.
Are you saying it's the Soul survivor?
It is the Soul Survivor. Oh, man. You are our best title writer, Greg, and I'm glad to see that translate to the podcast. Thank you. Have you ever owned any hatchbacks, Greg?
Yeah, I had a Mini Cooper S in 03 back probably a decade ago. I know Chris has a Mini Cooper as well, not the S, so missing out on that supercharger, but it's a fantastic car either way.
Yep. So funny you should mention that. I took delivery of it October 31st, so almost... We're only a few weeks out of 2005. So
oh my God!
It's still in the garage, and I still have it. So it's coming
How many miles
up on
do you
14
have on
years.
It?
It's like a week away.
How many miles are on it?
Just shy of 60.
Oh my God! How many miles do you drive? Like
so,
two a week?
The thing is, I got it when I was in college, and then I spent a little over... So I didn't drive that much in college, and then
sure.
I moved to Germany for a little over a year, and so my parents would occasionally drive it to work just to put miles on it. So there was kind of... There was some time when it was more or less off the road. So, yeah, it's very low mileage.
Wow, for 14 years, man. That's getting your money's worth, though.
Good job. Totally. Yeah, I've had... Nary a problem with it. I had a misfire a few years ago and had some little minor stuff. The coolant overfill tank cracked, which is a really common issue. But yeah, it's been a good
I
car.
I feel like modern minis, especially the first generation, were a lot of car enthusiasts, not just ones that turned into journalists like us, but it's a very common popular car with enthusiasts because... It's functional and it's fun.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it's super tossable. That's what I love about
exactly.
Like, even when I go get the groceries during the weekend, I'll, you know, kind of wind it out in second. And it's nice because it's a slow car that you can drive fast.
Yeah.
And it feels kind of, you know, they talk about go-kart-like handling. And it kind of has that to a certain extent. But it only has, I think that it's 118 horsepower, 120, something like that. So it's not that much power in a very tossable thing. So you can kind of rev it out and pretend like you're going fast and not be breaking the law.
And that's the first gen of the modern Mini before they got all big and fat too. So
right.
That's everyone's, well, I think still everyone's favorite.
And Chris, yours is an 05. And is it a stick shift?
It is.
Yeah, so you have the Getra gearbox and not the crummy,
yes.
What was it, Midlands in the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
very nice.
You have
very
the prime one of the non-S's.
It's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Hold on to it. Yeah, man. It'll start appreciating eventually.
Yeah, if I keep it long enough.
Yeah, lock it up. Stop driving it.
Keep driving it. At this rate, it's only going to have 80,000 miles by 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I don't think you could put miles on it fast enough to make a difference. That's it for the Golf 8. We're going to wait for some more information like pricing and the all-important information of whether or not it's going to come to the U.S. That's what we're waiting for. But in the meantime, a lot of other things have happened this week, and I want to bring up two in particular. And the first one has to do with the Mustang, but it isn't the Mustang. And what I'm talking about is the upcoming Mustang-inspired electric crossover coming from Ford. We don't know the name of it yet, although the name Mach 1 has been thrown around, but there was a little bit of backlash. The news this week, though, is that Ford released a teaser, and it's a side profile. It's not a photo. It's more just like lines that show the shape of it. But this is the clearest kind of look we've had at what this machine is going to look like. And a couple of things I'll point out that are really obvious from this teaser. One is it's, you know, definitely indicating in the taillight area that the taillights are going to be very Mustang-like. It's got like three lines that I think indicate the three sections of the taillights of the Mustang that are pretty iconic. Also, the hood shape looks very Mustang-like as well. But it's
also... I would say the headlights do too.
Yeah, the headlights as well. It's unmistakably, though, a crossover. You know, it's not a coupe. And I think what we don't know, and what they don't show in the teaser at all, they don't show the wheels or the fenders, and particularly the ride height. And that's what I'd like to know is this thing going to be high riding? Is it going to be tall? Or is this kind of going to be a little lower to the ground, which I think would actually be really cool if it were. Now, we've all had a chance to see it, so I wanted to get some reactions. Greg, what do you think of this teaser? Does it make you excited for the debut, which happens November 17th? Are you still pretty skeptical about whether or not this car is going to turn out to be a good idea?
I'm just more in this camp of I'm kind of excited for it because I think electric, for better or worse, is the future. And it sounds like Ford's got the or we're reporting 300 miles of range, possibly multiple battery packs. But I'm very concerned the bean counters are going to get in the way and name everything Mustang. Like, you know, I know that they wanted to call this thing Mach 1 at first and then everyone kind of complained and now it's not that. But there's a lot of Mustang, it looks like, in this little teaser image. And I think it's just going to be Ford Mustang SUV EV, Ford Mustang F-150 pickup truck. I could just see this future of Ford trying to associate Mustang with EV for some reason.
I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
So going off of what Greg's, I think from kind of what we've heard, I have a feeling you might be right. We did a story, I think like 2-3 months back now, about Ford kind of wanting to create sub-brands within its range. So there'd be like the Mustang sub-brand and the Bronco sub-brand, which we're already seeing with there's going to be the big Bronco and then the smaller one. So I, for better or worse, I think you're right there. Looking at this line drawing, though, what gets me when I keep looking at it is I'm trying to figure out, is Ford going to surprise us and make this thing a two-door or three-door with the hatchback? Because I'm trying to figure out how you would incorporate rear doors into this design the way it's shown here, at least. Because it looks like where the rear door openings would be into the fender, kind of where the fenders widen out and where the roof starts to drop downward. So I'm wondering if maybe there couldn't be a surprise in store. I don't know.
You know, now that I'm looking at it and you point out where the rear fender starts, you're right. That starts way further up than you would think it normally would if there's a door there. Although it's possible the rear doors could be like a half door situation, which sure. We've been seeing a lot of lately. Man, if it were a two door or a three door, that would be shocking. To reply to your comment, Greg, I think I've said this on the podcast before. Even I think associating their first really serious attempt at an EV with a Mustang is a really good idea because one thing that I see that's lacking with the competitors that try to take on Tesla, and let's take the Chevy Bolt, for example, is a lack of a cool factor. The Bolt is an exceptional electric vehicle ever since it came out, and more so now that they've added even more range. You know, it's a 250-plus mile EV that is very affordable and functional and does everything you want. But it doesn't have a cool factor. And the problem is that Tesla right now, you know, has the cool factor of the iPod in like, you know, 2002, right? It's off the charts. So everybody that tries to go up against Tesla, I think, is missing that kind of key element, even if they're making a decent or even a great product. And I think what Ford is trying to do is take their one asset that they know is cool, that, you know, is cool to the bone, and associating it with EVs. Now the question is, and so many things we don't know, is how that's all going to come together. You know, is it going to have impressive enough range? Is it going to have impressive enough performance? Is it going to look cool like a Mustang? And I think based on this teaser, you know, again, it's just some lines, so we're not seeing a photo or anything. But I think it will look cool based on what we're seeing. So I'm hyped for it. I'm jazzed. I think it's their it's their game to lose right now. They're setting this up nicely as to be a really really attractive EV that could shake things up. And that's really been the hard part, is to shake up this this EV market in the U.S. because it's 85% Tesla, and that's not hyperbole. It's like 85% of all EVs sold in the U.S. are Teslas. And the Porsche, the Taycan, that was a nice shot across the bow, but also it wasn't a direct hit either, just because the price was so high. or is so high, and they put such an emphasis on performance that the range wasn't there where it is in the Tesla. So I don't know. I think this Mustang is so interesting, or this Mustang inspired EV crossover. We really need a name for it, because I can't keep saying that. That is too much. But November 17th. So it's actually, for those who don't know, it's actually a Sunday, which it's on the Sunday of the week that the LA Auto Show is happening. So it's going to debut before the LA Auto Show, and then I assume they're going to have the actual car at the show as well later that week. So we will be there covering everything and bringing you videos and pictures and analysis of this, because I think this might be the biggest debut of the show. I think it definitely is of what we know so far. So we'll wait and see if some other debuts come up that challenge it, but I don't know. All right. The other thing that happened this week, in addition to the Golf 8 debuting, was the Tokyo Motor Show. And this is a kind of a weird motor show for us, because it's really hard to get to. So it's hard for us to cover sometimes. But we did have, I think, four editors from across the Motor One network in Tokyo this week to cover it. And there were definitely some interesting debuts. I wouldn't say there was as many as maybe what we're used to seeing in like a Geneva Motor Show or a Frankfurt or a Detroit, but there were still some good ones. I wanted to bring up a few, like maybe we could each pick the one debut we thought was most interesting. And I'll go first. I thought the most interesting one, speaking of electric vehicles, was the Mazda MX-30, which is Mazda's very first electric vehicle. It's a really interesting design in that it's kind of like a hatchback, and it has two regular doors and two half doors behind it that open in a suicide style. So very much like the BMW i3, which I'm going to bring up again because it has to share some other things in common with the i3. I think it looks really cool, and the interior is particularly futuristic. That's actually what I love about a lot of the EVs that come out, is they tend to have very futuristic interiors to like accommodate and accentuate all of their technology. The thing that is, while I think the design is cool and the packaging, what's disappointing is the actual hardware. It has a fairly small battery that is probably, it's not rated in the US yet by the EPA, but it looks like it's only going to be in the low hundreds in terms of range in miles.
Which is just embarrassing, honestly.
It is. And that's why I brought up the i3, because the i3 is another vehicle that has like really cool design, really interesting packaging, and BMW put a way too small battery in it. Now, what's interesting is that BMW also added a strange little range extender as an option on the i3, and it was rumored that Mazda was going to do the same, and that it was going to be a Wankel engine for the range extender. But they debuted it, and they never mentioned the range extender, and they just debuted it as an EV with a really small battery. And of course, they have a bunch of reasons why they say having a range of like, again, we don't know what it'll exactly be, but let's say between 120, 140 miles, something like that. You know, they say that, you know, that's enough for most people to drive in a day and all of that. But I've made this argument to many people that, you know, range anxiety is real, and it's not really about how far you can go in a day. It's just about for one thing, I think it's about matching gas cars, if that makes any sense. Like, you know, people are going to look at EVs as inferior to gas cars until the range question is just equalized. And I think to do that, you at the minimum need more than 200 miles. And in my personal opinion, I think 300 miles is better, but you know, 200, 250 at least. And for this, yeah, I don't know. They made a lot of comments that it'll do well in Japan. So maybe they'll make changes before it comes over to the US, like add the range extender or possibly a bigger battery, but I don't know what the platform can handle. So it was a very, very weird debut, because it's a super interesting car and had was really neat design and really clever packaging. But yeah, the battery size just kind of made me do a sad trombone sound for it.
Well, I didn't hear that, or maybe I'm just out of the loop, but they didn't announce it was coming to the US yet.
No, they didn't. But I imagine they have plans to sell EVs around the world, so we'll wait and see what those are. If they're only selling it in Japan, maybe that argument holds for only 120 miles will be, you know, plenty for everyone, because it's a lot smaller distances to travel there. But even still, if you're going to sell it anywhere outside of Japan, I don't think that argument holds anymore.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that will ultimately make it here. If I were a gambling person, at least at the range it has, I would say I think it'll be like the Honda E, something we kind of look at afar, like bring it here, even though it's really not perfect because the range is a little too small, but it's just cool enough. We want it. But I would imagine they'll probably wait it out. There's not a huge incentive to bring it here with that low range, and we're not big EV buyers.
And I mean, this is Mazda's, I mean, first experimentation with electrification altogether, as far as I know. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that because I haven't looked closely at all of their Japanese offerings, but you know, they haven't even had a hybrid in the US, you know, so it kind of feels to me like they're leapfrogging right to full electrification. And yeah, I don't know. I'm, you know, it's funny, you know, you say, I got to read the press release, because all of the press photos that they released with it are not of the car in Tokyo, unless Tokyo looks a lot like Europe, in these pictures. Well, Greg, what did you think was the most interesting car at Tokyo for you?
I mean, there's a difference between interesting, the one that interested me. The most interesting was definitely the Suzuki Hustler, because why you would name it after Larry Flint's magazine is strange to me. The most interesting to me as a U.S. consumer, though, is the Subaru Levorg prototype they brought out, which we're not getting the Levorg as a wagon, but it pretty much signals what the new WRX is going to look like. And it looks pretty good. And the Levorg has this new 1.8-liter turbo flat four that I would imagine is not going to come here, but maybe the WRX will have a 1.8-liter turbo flat four. The car is interesting to me, and I think it has an impact on us, where a lot of the other stuff that debuts in Japan is interesting, but it's tough to find where it ties into the U.S.
Right. Interesting but irrelevant, usually.
Which is a bit of it's really handsome. Like, you know, it's a really handsome car, and it is just unfortunate that, you know, Subaru sells so many Outbacks here that they have no incentive to bring this here, because it would just steal sales from the Outback.
Even just jack it up a little and put some body cladding on it. I mean, there's going to be some purists who are like, I wanted an actual WRX wagon like the Levorg is supposed to be, but I'd be happy with like an Outbackified version of it.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Did you guys see that article recently? I forget where it was published, but it was something like 85% of all station wagons sold in the U.S. are Outbacks.
Yep, I did see that.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
People love Outbacks.
So yeah, if you're Subaru, I would love to say, like, if you're Subaru, you should be the wagon, you know, carrying the banner for wagons and bring as many over as you can. But you're right. I think their incentive is just to sell more Outbacks.
Especially since they're made in, you know, Subaru makes the U.S. Outback in Indiana, so, you know, they don't have to worry about tariffs. It's just kind of, you know, they make them there and bring them in. So there's not much incentive to go elsewhere.
Yeah, they're set up perfectly for that. How about you, Chris? What did you like or find interesting from Tokyo?
So my personal favorite is the absolutely bizarre Suzuki Waku Spo, or SPO. I'm not exactly sure how you're supposed to say it, but if I'm honest, of what the other important debuts there, the Nissan Ariya concept is probably more important. Yeah. Even if I don't find it quite as cool, it's an idea for kind of a mid-size electric crossover, and it's probably kind of the shape that we're going to see from Nissans to come. It's got this big arching roof that looks really nice, but then it's pointy at both ends. It's a pretty handsome vehicle, and it's not, you know, it's the type of thing that you could kind of imagine seeing on a Murano or something like that in the future, and
they've trademarked the name Ariya here, and that car looks pretty production ready. So that car actually, I forgot about it, Chris, but that's probably the most important debut there to America, because we know they have a rogue-sized SUV thing coming, and that's it, pretty much.
Oh, and I Nissan, did not realize that they patented or trademarked the name. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, Nissan. Oh, well, first of all, I love the name because it reminds me of Game of Thrones. Second of all, Nissan, I'm surprised that Nissan it's taken them this long to get a second EV model on the market. Like, maybe it makes sense because while the Leaf is, I don't know if the Leaf is still the best-selling EV in the U.S. or if the Model 3 overtook it, but nevertheless, it was and has been a good-selling electric vehicle in the U.S. Maybe it never sold enough, though, to justify a second vehicle, but the Leaf has been around so long, and Nissan has beaten the drum for EVs and been, I would say, a genuine advocate of them as opposed to building them to meet compliances or, you know, laws. That I'm really excited for them, for their like second effort, and the fact that it'll be a crossover, I think will be cool. We were actually just shopping for a slightly used EV, and I test drove a Nissan Leaf, and believe it or not, I'd never driven one. And it was remarkable. It was like a 2016. And they had upgraded the battery, so it had 107 miles of range. And again, this is at a time when, the EVs did not have large ranges, but Nissan was trying to push the envelope and push it as high as possible so that they wouldn't be just, you know, second cars and that people could use them. Whereas other, you know, automakers were, you know, like Fiat were happy to sell the 500 with 80 miles of range and never touch it and actually encourage people not to buy it. Nissan was the opposite. This Aria, I agree. I think it's perhaps the most significant vehicle at the show because it supposedly alludes to the EV crossover that we're going to get in the U.S. Very good choice. Although I like your first choice too. That Suzuki concept was hella cool.
Yeah. Do you like the looks of the Aria though, John?
Nissan design, I'm always a little torn on. Let me put it this way. I don't have faith that the production car is going to look as good as this. So even if I say I like this, like, I don't really think the production car is going to look this good.
See, I think that thing looks pretty production ready. I think it'll look a little worse in production form, but I think it'll look about 80% of that. It has mirrors on it, too. Like, that's the key. When you know a car is like at prototype stage or full concept, and they put real mirrors on it, not stupid camera mirrors, or maybe not stupid.
Well, real mirrors real mirrors and real doors with an actual B pillar. That you're right. That does suggest production ready. And the interior, the interior looks a little concepty.
It's a little concepty, but it looks like you could erase some of the whatever they like shiny bits, and you'd have a pretty close to real interior.
But I like it. The interior is very similar to the Model 3, where it's just like this big screen on the dash and like very few buttons otherwise. Very cool. Yeah, it's a cool. Yeah, Nissan needs to, I think, step up and take their place as the company that has been, aside from Tesla, pushing EVs for so long. I don't know. They have a lot of other things that they're trying to.
You mean like make money?
Right now. Yeah. So maybe that's not in the cards for them. All right. Well, we want to hear what everyone else thinks about the Golf 8, the Mustang EV, and everything that was at the Tokyo show. So you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Motor1.com. And of course, on our website, Motor1.com, where you can find us in the comments. Coming up, we're going to find out what we've been driving this week. But before the break, I want to remind everyone that if you're listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else that you listen to your favorite podcasts. Welcome back. During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today, we're going to start with you, Greg. What are you driving?
I am in the 2020 Mazda 3 sedan. I wanted to say 2023 because the 3 in it, but it's a 2020 Mazda 3 sedan with all-wheel drive, top of the line, almost $30,000. It's a beautiful car. It's something about it I just don't love. I like it a lot. The interior's gorgeous. The exterior, I think the sedan looks better than the hatch. And you drive it, and it feels like a little luxury car, but that little bit of, like, soul that the old 3 had or other Mazdas have, it's a little less present and probably better for actually convincing people to buy these cars. But for somebody who gets in a 3 and thinks like that's going to be fun to hustle around, it's a little less, feels a little more adult.
Oh, this is actually a really good word for it. It feels a little like a little bit more adult and less fun. I mean, you're driving around in Miami, right?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty good for Miami. There's very few, you know, you got on ramps to kind of play with. And besides that, it's mostly straight lines. So it's really great for
that. Well, I was going to ask, not that there's a lot of snow falling where I am in Cleveland right now, but, you know, it has all-wheel drive. Do you think that, do you feel like that you could feel that the presence of the all-wheel drive, or did that affect the driving in any way? And also, follow-up question, do you think that that makes a difference to the buyer in this class?
Well, a couple things on that. The first thing is the all-wheel drive. I was curious, too, if I'm really noticing or not. There's, I want to say at torque peaks, 186 pound-feet at 4,000 RPM. So below that, it's not like it's gutless, but you feel a little like, come on, baby. And I feel like the front-wheel drive one might have that a little less. It might be the extra weight of the whole rear differential. But I will say I was like on a slightly dusty road and I had to beat somebody off the line to get in the other lane to get on the on-ramp once the light turned green. And the front wheels gave a nice little spin before it sent power rearward. So I was kind of depressed how slow it was to react. And also maybe it's not as big of a thing as I would think. I wish I had time. I would love to drive a front-wheel drive one to get a better vibe if that's kind of sucking a little life from it or not. But I do think this segment, maybe it's not a be all end all thing to have all wheel drive, but I think it's a nice thing to have. You look at how Subaru is not having much trouble, it seems, selling anything, and they're all wheel drive.
But with Subaru and the Impreza, I feel like they get, like, obviously they Subaru gives you all wheel drive standard, plus they just have engineered and evolved their system for so long. There feels like there's zero penalty in the Impreza for having all wheel drive. Like the fuel economy is just as good as its front wheel drive competitors. Where I feel like every other automaker who offers all wheel drive makes it feel like an extra thing that comes with compromises. Like A, you have to pay more for it, and B, your fuel economy is going to go down. So that's why I feel like in this segment where you have like a Subaru next to you, all-wheel drive never looks good as an option on another car. You know, it kind of just always makes me look at the Subaru more.
Well, I will say, I think you are probably like a lot of consumers who, people like Subaru, and I like Subaru a lot too.
Yeah.
But in theory, if you get in a Subaru Impreza and you're like, I just need a small car with all-wheel drive, I don't like A, B, or C about this Subaru. What else can I get? There's nothing else. Mazda's at least filling a gap in the market. I don't think many people get in the Impreza and say, I hate this so much, I'm looking for something else. Unfortunately for Mazda.
Yeah, but it's a small gap to fill.
Yeah, but you know, if there are people who get in and are like, man, I just hate this infotainment system in the Subaru, which they'd be crazy. I love the Subaru infotainment system. But now there's the Mazda to look at.
It's an even smaller gap because most people would think, I want all-wheel drive, I'll just get a crossover. I don't think the market of people who want small sedans is already shrinking. And if those people also want all-wheel drive, there's so much pressure to push them into a crossover, of which, you know, almost all of them have all-wheel drive. So I don't know, like offering all-wheel drive just seemed like a strange decision to me with a Mazda 3. And I've driven it too, and honestly, I couldn't really feel a difference. So it was, you know, I said in my head, well, I wouldn't pay extra for this. I mean, it might be nice in the few months of the year where it's winter, but you know, like we always say, a good set of snow tires does most of the work, you know, anyway.
I also think, part of it in their marketing minds, totally me guessing here, but, you know, it's no secret Mazda's trying to, I don't know if reach full premium level status, but, you know, move up from being more than just your typical mainstream brand. And they probably are looking at Audi, and you can get an A3 with all-wheel drive. They're like, they're doing it. People expect all-wheel drive to be available in your, you know, entry-level luxury-ish sedan. We need to offer this.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think almost every Mazda that sold is trying to punch above its weight class in terms of luxury, and does so very well. Although there's still in my mind just a dissonance with associating Mazda with luxury or competing against luxury brands. Like, I mean, to me, just having covered it for so long, it's a mainstream brand. It's not a luxury brand. But every time we drive one or put it in a comparison test, we comment on how much more luxurious and premium it feels versus a Ford or a Honda or whatever. So they are doing well at that, but I don't know if they're going to overcome just people's mindset of where Mazda is in the pecking order.
Have you driven an A3 sedan or CLA recently, Greg? That can you comment on that at all?
I haven't driven a CLA in forever, but I remember not being... I haven't driven the new CLA, so it's not fair to me for me to comment on the old CLA or the new A-Class.
Fair enough.
A3, it's been a couple years, but the A3 feels, you know, always felt really good. It's, you know, an Audi Golf, for better or worse.
Sure.
It's MQB, and it's kind of like what the 3 to some degree feels like, where it's this really comfortable, nice, almost isolated, but if you kind of get on it, there is enough there where it's still, like, engaging enough, but it's not the old 3 or a Civic or, you know, something that's a little bit more involving with you. But I think it's a good compromise of hitting what people really want.
If you were in the market, though, do you think you would genuinely cross-shop a Mazda 3 with an Audi A3?
Depends, because in the world we live in where we're so boxed in, which is, I wish the world was more like this, where it's just like, hey, I'm looking at a new car, new A3 or new Mazda 3, I don't really think so. But if somebody says, hey, there's a CPO Audi A3 here with 20,000 miles on the odometer, and it's, you know, about the same, it's about $30,000, and so is this Mazda 3, I think that's a fair, you know, I think Mazda's put itself in a position where people might say, why get a slightly used Audi A3 when I can get a brand new Mazda 3?
Yeah, possibly. Like, you could definitely see the product planning meetings they're having and the lines they're drawing between like Audi and themselves and the situations where they might be able to pick up a sale. I don't know, but like I said, it just seems like a narrow path to walk that doesn't lead to overwhelming amounts of sales, but really leads to a good reputation and I think a lot of critical praise, which they're getting from people like us. All right, let's move on. Chris, I don't think you drove anything new this week, did you?
Nope, nothing new. How about you?
Well, I did have a new car in the driveway. It was the Infiniti QX60, which I've been calling Old Gray. and it's funny because I'd just driven the Nissan Pathfinder before it and kind of had the same feelings, which is that these are ancient three-row crossovers, you know, and they're related. You know, the Infiniti is just the luxurious version of the Pathfinder. And when I get into it, it really hits you on the inside because the controls, the buttons, the layout of the dash, the screen, the infotainment system are all a generation or two old. Like, it all feels very old. However, I wanted to guard myself against being too critical of it because I can usually get really down on cars that are just happen to be more than a few years since their last redesign, and so I was trying to have an open mind and I've kind of evolved to have have positive feelings towards the QX60. For one, I think its exterior design has aged pretty well. I particularly like the D-pillar that has that kind of signature Infiniti character line in it that I think works really well and actually serves a nice functional purpose because it makes a really big sheet of glass for the third row passenger if you happen to be sitting back there. And I think the front end of it looks good too. So I think its design has held up fairly well and you wouldn't be ashamed to have it parked in your driveway. And as for the interior, even though everything looks to me old, I don't know that, you know, an average buyer who gets in it would think that. And even if it is old, it doesn't perform poorly. It's not ergonomically terrible, you know. So it's like, it's not bad. It's just old. And I guess I can't say with 100% confidence that old equals bad in this instance. It's just, I'm sick of seeing it. That's what I think is really hitting me when I get in it. But I think, you know, I'm going to review this one, and I think ultimately it's going to get dinged pretty hard for not driving particularly well. And when I say that, it drives comfortably, especially, you know, on the highway, it's very comfortable, but there's no driving enjoyment whatsoever. The engine isn't particularly gutsy or powerful, nor is the transmission, you know, I think a perfect partner for it. So there's not tons of power to play with. The handling, the suspension, totally soft. I mean, you can't take speed into corners with this thing at all. And it's just not fun to, you know, go run an errand in. It's almost minivan like in its demeanor. And that sounds harsh, but again, I always try to put myself in the shoes of an average consumer and ask myself, would I notice this? Would I notice that it isn't as fun to drive as some others? And I think, you know, if I'm a person that's going to go drive a QX60, and then I'm going to go to a Volvo dealership and drive an XC60, and then I'm going to go to, you know, or XC90, and then I'm going to go around and drive some more. I mean, if I got to the, like, Buick X7, I'd never think of the Infiniti again, you know? So that's, I think, its danger is one drive in a more modern luxury three-row crossover, and there's no way you're going to buy the Infiniti.
And it's priced similarly, too. It's not, you know, that's the thing with the car. I want to give it, like, you know, everything you said, it's very minivan-like. It's minivan without the space, and everything in it is old. That doesn't mean it's terrible, but it's not as good as the newer stuff. And you're like, well, maybe it's a cheap, you know, price for what it is, but it's not. It's priced about the same as, like, an XC90.
Yeah, so I have the sticker for the one I'm driving right in front of me. Out the door, it's $62,000. And the base price of it was, of this model, was $48,000. This one is the Lux all-wheel drive, which I don't know off the top of my head is the highest trim level. Usually they are when they're media vehicles that we're reviewing. And I mean, Nissan does have a knack of, even as cars get old, they do manage to, like, jam in all the latest tech features. Which they've done here. Like, you know, it's got, you know, all the drive, the drive assist stuff. It's got, I mean, the whole roof has a moonroof. What else? Apple CarPlay and all that. Like, so they jam in all the new stuff, but it just never feels like the components they use are the highest quality. Like, I don't know.
Maybe this is just my perspective, but it seems like ever since Johan Dinayachin left, it's just been kind of it's been a brand without any direction.
Oh, treading water. Yeah, I agree. I mean, what is the last new Infiniti that came out?
QX50.
Oh yeah, yeah. Which was a good one. Yeah, that felt like a good step towards, like, revitalizing the whole brand with new models, and then stall, right? And maybe that has more to do with parent company Nissan and all the things it's dealing with. But yeah, the QX50 felt like a really good step in the right direction, and then kind of nothing. And it's certainly, you know, in the crossover market is where you want to be, you know, launching your best products and your newest stuff. And this third row crossover segment is really heating up. Like I said, I mentioned the X7. That's BMW's first entry into it, and is a really
good. Well, X7's a little bigger, and they used to have an X5.
It's a little bigger, but it's still a three-row. It's still a three-row luxury crossover.
Yeah. This thing, though, it seems like it's a car that you get because they have a really good special on it. Like, if anybody pays full price for it, I'm not trying to be judgy toward people in their car choice. If you really like it, that's your car. Go for it. But if you're like, I'm only whatever with it, but I'm going to get the Infiniti, and you paid full price, that is crazy to me. When, like, even the MDX, you know, the MDX drives well and feels a little bit special. You know, this feels like a Nissan Pathfinder with some lipstick on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we'll see. My review will be out in a few weeks, and you can read all of my opinions there again. So that's what we're driving this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Chris Bruce at ChrisBruce1985 on Twitter. Greg, I don't have your Twitter handle in front of me. Can you remind me?
The Thinker.
Oh, The Thinker. How could I forget that? That's my favorite.
I thought you were setting me up, because last time you did that, you're like, yeah, I just wanted you to say it, Greg.
Yeah, I wasn't. I really didn't have it written down. And you can follow me on Twitter at John_M_Neff. I want to thank you two for being on the show with me this week.
It was great being here.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome. And of course, thank all of you out there for listening. Come back next week, where we'll have an all new episode.